50 years have gone by since what Makes Sammy Run was out. It's actually not 50 years, though, is it?
It's not quite, no.
50 years next year, right?
It's actually, yeah, next year. Yeah.
Why did they jump the gun?
Well, it seemed like a convenient number. I find that even my 10-year-old son, they taught them to round out in arithmetic. They said to round it out. So I guess what Random House did was to round it out at 1990.
Mm. You were, what, about 20? You were in your early 20s when that book was first published.
It's about, I don't know, 20. I guess about 27 when I finished it.
Well, tell me how the book came about and how it was conceived.
How it was conceived.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I guess it was conceived with me being a Hollywood child, growing up in Hollywood. My father was the head of a big studio.
A Hollywood prince, I think.
Hollywood prince is what I called myself. Mm-hmm. And I was too, on one side I was treated that way. As a kid I could ride my bike right through those famous gates of Paramount Studio, play on the back lot.
I believe you were chauffeured to your newspaper route.
I was, yes. Actually, my mother, Ann Schulberg, had a very strong work ethic, and she really taught us that, but impressed on us that we should all work. And so, I guess very early, I started both trying to write as a 10 or 11-year-old, and also selling Orangeade on the corners, and sort of built up until finally I was on Western Avenue selling the Saturday Evening Post and the Country Gentleman and the Ladies' Home Journal. I was driven in a chauffeur-driven limousine, chauffeur sitting outside, mm-hmm. and I'd be dropped about a block and a half away from my corner, and then I would sneak out. I had trained myself. I traveled in that car on the floor of the car, crouched down in sort of fetal position so that nobody would see me. And then as a chauffeur, he was actually a uniformed chauffeur. I remember the uniform pretty well. Opened the door, I would sort of crawl out and crawl 8 or 10 steps and then jump up as if, who me, that's doesn't have anything to do with me. And then I would I'd sell my magazines. It didn't quite dawn on me at that time that maybe only 15 years later I'd be writing for those magazines.
Mm, yeah. You people see you as a Californian, but you are actually a New York boy, weren't you?
Well, not really, no. I'm really a California boy, and I'm an L.A. high school boy. I went out there when I was a child. I was born in New York City, but I had no memory of New York. I had no memory of the East at all. It was all sort of sneak previews and palm trees for me until I came east after Los Angeles High School. I went to college up at Dartmouth. I went to Deerfield for 1 year after I got out of L.A. High, as they thought that I needed a year to sort of be ready for Eastern culture.
Now, there are some parallels between Sammy Glick and V.P. Schulberg, your father. Your father also worked as a cub reporter for a newspaper in New York, and in fact, I believe he was an assistant to Franklin P. Adams, who wrote the
Well, he was. He was really. He'd be happy to hear that he was really a. He was a copy boy for FPA. He was once a famous name, famous columnist, and VP. My father was a copy boy at that time, but My father suffered from a lack of the aggressive social qualities that Sammy Glick, or attributes or points or whatever you give him. My father wasn't tough enough to finally, I think, survive that business. He was much more, in the book, What Made Sammy Run, I thought of my father much more like Sidney Feynman, who's the head of the studio, who Sammy Glick takes over from and moves him out. In the book, Feynman finally has a fatal heart attack. BP was not S.G. or Sammy Glick, but there were an awful lot of Sammys around BP.
Well, I bet there were. When the book came out, you were back in Hollywood, working, I believe, for MGM as an apprentice screenwriter. Wasn't that true?
Well, almost. Not quite. I was at that moment, I was actually working for Sam Goldwyn, who was a middle G in MGM, but who had long before then given up any interest in the company. Sam Goldwyn was an independent producer, cussedly independent his whole life. And I was working for him when the book came out.
Well, the book made quite an impression out in Hollywood. What was some of the reaction like?
I was a bit apprehensive, as my father had warned me. In fact, warn is an understatement. My father had actually asked me in a letter not to publish the book. He thought the book would ruin me. He thought that I would never work again in Hollywood, that I'd be run out of town. And even though by that time I'd published maybe 10 or 12 short stories in national magazines, he was worried as to how I would survive economically. Maybe he was worried about himself as well. But so I was, in a way, forewarned that there would be a very strong reaction to this book. Even forewarned, I wasn't totally prepared for how strong the reaction was.
You were forewarned, but at the same time, many first novels, nobody reads them. I mean, they come out, and a few hundred copies are purchased. And
true. Well, this novel was it really was a phenomenon. No one at Random House, Bennett Cerf, who was the head of Random House at the time, my editor, Sax Cummins, wonderful editor, nobody expected anything like what happened. Nobody anticipated it. In fact, quite the reverse. Bennett said, Bud, we will publish this book because we think that you're a very promising writer, and we think that you can, that you'll write other things after this, but don't plan to retire on this book, because we've had only trouble with Hollywood novels. He had a theory that Hollywood novels don't sell, and that they had recently had a very bad experience with Nathaniel West's novel, The Day of the Locust, which everyone admired in terms of writing, but it actually did not get back its $500 advance.
But became a classic, almost in the same way
in,
that Makes Sammy Run
had. In time.
Yeah, in time. Yeah, I reread What Makes Sammy Run last week, and it holds up wonderfully. I mean, there are some dated references, like Sammy wants to do a radio column, and I think there's a long train ride.
Yes.
But other than that, you know, it's wonderful. Mm-hmm. And something else is interesting. At the end, you have two short stories, one of which is called Love Comes to Sammy Glick, I believe, right?
Mm-hmm. The first in the magazine was called What Makes Sammy Run.
Uh-huh.
And then which was almost like the opening chapter of the book.
Right. Some of the names were a little different.
Yes. I changed the names a bit.
And the other one is Love Comes to Sammy Glick.
That's right, which was more or less like the ending of the book, in which Sammy, I followed the sexual progress of Sammy quite carefully in the book. He has a little sweet girlfriend, what he calls a nebbish back in New York, Rosalie Goldbaum, and he leaves her behind. He leaves people as he moves up. He also, in a way, even moves up in steps of what he thinks the women can do for him. And he finally winds up with the daughter of the Eastern power, because even when we were living in Hollywood, New York was a scary name. Everybody at the top of the business were always afraid of New York, which meant that the owners of the companies that controlled the studios, what were they thinking? And so in the book, when he marries not the boss's daughter, like the boss of Warner Brothers or something, but the daughter of the Wall Street company that really controls the studio, he feels at that point he's really made it. And then there was a kind of surprising denouement for Sammy at the end of the novel.
So you wrote, initially, you wrote the two short stories, and the novel is an elaboration of those two short stories.
Right, yeah. Actually, the book came out of the stories. Bennett Serve at Random House came up to Dartmouth when I was the editor of the daily paper there, and I was raising hell there about the marble. There was a marble strike going on, and I was writing a lot about this marble strike. And I was writing pretty well about it, too. I mean, I was telling it truly as it was up there in the very cold and what the miners were going through. I had no idea that Bennett was at the Hanover Inn on a lecture tour, and he phoned me. I was in my office at the editor's office at the paper, and he asked me if I would come over to the inn, which was about half a block away, and I ran over and saw Bennett, and he says that he'd been reading these pieces. He was very impressed with the articles and said, I think it was the first time, no, it was not the first time that it ever came in my mind to write a novel, but he said, if you ever think of writing a novel, come to us at Random House. And so after the short stories appeared, I spoke to Bennett again, and it sort of evolved out of the short stories and my talks with Bennett Cerf at Random House. And so it's a kind of full circle feeling for me that I should be back at Random House and that they should be publishing the book, republishing it now in this edition.
Yeah, it should be noted that the 50th anniversary edition does contain those two original stories. And there's a companion volume that Random House has brought out, too, called Love, Action, Laughter, and Other Sad Tales, a collection of short stories. These are actually earlier short stories of yours, aren't they?
They're over a long period. I wrote a book of short stories a long time back called the overall title was Some Faces in the Crowd. And they also covered a very long period from early to late. And it's the same with these. These are stories that some of them I wrote very young. One was all the way back to intercollegiate short story contest when I was at Dartmouth, and that was run in Story magazine. It's almost like a novelette. It's sort of between a short story and a long, long story. And some of them are more recent, and three or four have not been published.
One of my favorite books of yours is a book that had come out a number of years ago called The Four Seasons of Success, and then it was republished by Saul Stein a few years later and updated with the new title, Writers in America. By the way, I was talking to Saul a couple of weeks ago. You know, he's fallen on very hard times with the loss of his publishing.
I know, and I feel sorry for Saul.
Yeah, it's I've interviewed him before on much happier occasions, and he seemed down. You know, he said he had lost his health and his life savings and the $300,000 he took out of his house to try to prop the business up.
He's had a tough time. It's very it's very hard being a independent publisher, I think, today. I'm sorry, but I did appreciate the fact that he published the book, even though Saul, at the same time, was pretty well known among his writers for never sending any statements to his writers, so I have no idea whether it sold 10 copies or 300 or 3,000.
That's a universal complaint, I can assure you that. But it's so interesting, these writers that you knew, and one of the chapters about F. Scott Fitzgerald, of course, you can. That's more elaborated in your novel, The Disenchanted, which I guess is, well, it's fictionalized, but I guess the parallels are so close that it's really an accurate portrayal, isn't it?
Fairly. It's about 80%, I would say. The thing that struck me about my trip with Scott up to Dartmouth, which is, I would say, is the spine of the Disenchanted. What struck me is that if it happens once, I'm not sure that you have enough of a subject for a novel. But if the experience repeats and repeats itself, then you do. And that was my feeling. There was a very well-known writer, famous one, called John V.A. Weaver. He was a poet, he was a critic for The Old, and even better, Vanity Fair. He was a Hollywood film writer. And John V.A. Weaver, I asked him when I was still a student to come up and speak. I set up a meeting with the English department, very similar to what happened at the end of The Disenchanted. And when I went down to White River Junction and the train arrived and he came down the platform, John V.A. Weaver fell into my arms, dead drunk, and I had to decide, what do I do now? What do I do? Do I take him across the street to the Coolidge Hotel, or do I take him up to Dartmouth in this condition? And so these were things that kind of overlapped and overlapped. We could talk a long time about this, and I'll try to put it in a capsule, but Edwin Justice Mayer, who wrote two brilliant plays, The Children of Darkness, which was revived about 10 years ago with George Scott, a play called Firebrand, came to Hollywood, wonderful writer, wrote To Have and Have Not, which everybody thinks about Lubitsch, but he wrote the script. Eddie Mayer and I worked together for Sam Goldwyn, and it was Eddie who said he had diabetes and shouldn't drink, but every once in a while did, and gave me this equipment for a shot, which I used also in The Disenchanted, and said if I should go into a diabetic coma, I slightly faint. As a fight fan, I faint at the sight of blood. So he said, here's what you do, and he explained what to do. Well, I use things, all of those things. I use the experience of Weaver and Eddie Mayer and Herman Mankiewicz, who wrote Citizen Kane, and I sort of overlaid them. That's what every writer does,
yeah,
I think,
so you have,
with Scott.
Yeah, you have put together a number of different personalities in the same.
Yeah. I think that's the way we...
Composite, I think.
Yeah. I think it's the way we work. I really do. It always sounds like a sort of a legal defense, but I think it's basically true.
Well, you're still talking about fiction, but you don't develop fiction in a vacuum.
No.
Thinks that Waterfront, the movie, was made from your novel, but it's actually the other way around, wasn't it?
It was really much more the other way around. Although, what had happened is that, first, I had a very deep experience with The Waterfront. It wasn't like just sitting down, getting an assignment, and writing a movie. I had spent maybe a year and a half not just researching. It started with research, but it became involvement. I became involved with the Waterfront priest, Father Barry in the movie, Father John Corridon in real life, and also with these insurgent, as they called it, longshoremen, really gutsy people who were willing to stand up at meetings of the ILA, which was a front for the mob in New York, as I think it tends to be to this very day. And to stand up and get beaten and sometimes killed And I simply felt that I became, in a way, since I was able to write and they weren't, I was able to write their feelings. And so I wrote piece after piece for the New York Times Magazine, I think two or three, many others, Commonweal, liberal Catholic magazine. I wrote as much as I could about their cause before I got into it. By that time, I had so much material that it couldn't be squeezed into a 90-minute movie. And when the movie was over, some of this I had written down in long, long notes, and I didn't, it wasn't like a novelization, a word I hate, but it was really an extension of the work I had done on the waterfront.
Did you become friends with Leah Kazan?
Well, yes, we were, we had to become friends, because any two people who got kicked around in Hollywood, as the two of us did with the waterfront, we were turned down by every single studio. Every studio who read that script turned it down. They not only turned it down, they insulted it. I mean, Gerald Zanuck, head of 20th Century Fox, said, I don't think anybody, no, it was even stronger than that. When he finally saw us, he said, I think what you have written is exactly what the American people don't want to see. That's what he said. And then when we challenged him, he said, who's going to care about a lot of sweaty longshoremen? And this man, after all, is being paid millions of dollars to know what the public wants, but nobody does.
Yeah, and another classic. It's a classic film today, and as well as a classic book.
Yeah, and speaking of friendship, what made me admire Kazan was, as we got turned down, first by Fox, and then by Warners, and then by Paramount, and then by MGM, and then by Columbia, and then by Universal. And as I had warned him, because I was raised in Hollywood, and he wasn't, and when we went out there, he said, I love this. He said, this is one of the three best things I've ever had. He said, I think this stands with Streetcar and Death of a Salesman. He was sky high on this. And I said, Gadge, I don't think they're going to do it. I don't think they're going to do it. And he said, you're out of your mind, but they're going to love it. Well, they didn't love it. What I admired about him and what made us friends is that as we got turned down and turned down and turned down, instead of quitting the way so many would and go on to the next job, because he was very much in favor at that time, he said, but I told you this, I'm going to do this goddamn picture. I'm going to do this picture. If I have to get an IMO, in those days, a handheld camera, and we do it, take my own money, and we shoot it on the docks ourselves, I'm going to make this movie. And we went through so much misadventure that it was a bond.
Well, you have something else in common with Gadge, too. You were both friendly witnesses before the House Committee on Un-American Activities.
That was also true.
Yeah. When that happened, did your friends resent this, former friends, or how did this... what was your standing like after the testimony?
I had all kinds of friends. I had friends who were solid, strong, and still believing members of the Communist Party. I had friends who were half in the party and half out of the party because they were troubled by the pact between Stalin and Hitler. I had liberal friends who were outside of the party. I had conservative friends who had admired me as a writer. I had a whole range of friends. I would say that the irony of it was that the hardcore communists and the hardcore Hollywood establishment like L.B. Mayer and the heads of these studios, I lost, I guess, their friendship, or I gained their enmity. And it really was funny, although as you look back, the extreme left and the extreme right, like the globe, meet at some point in the, I don't know where, in some very cold region.
Had you at that point determined that the Communist Party was a threat to us?
In 52?
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was a threat from the time that I had trouble with the Communists over publishing What Makes Sammy, writing What Makes Sammy Run. I thought the Communist party had become a threat to the left wing, actually to the left wing and the labor movement and the left wing and the left liberal movement that I believe in. Yes, I did. I think it was a threat, and I think that there were a lot of frauds. I think that Lillian Hellman was a fraud. Not that she wasn't a gifted playwright, but I think that she was a fraud insofar as she pretended that she was not following the party line when she knew damn well that she was. Whether she was a member or not, I can't prove, but she was following the party line, and she was following it long, long after it seemed to me clear to any fair-minded person that this group, this power complex in Russia, were not the great humanitarians that we had thought that we were supporting and embracing and joining in the middle 30s, but that they were killing people, killing writers. As I once said to Lillian, they're killing writers who are better than we are.
Yeah, it should be noted that you were a youthful Communist Party member in the 1930s, but it was fashionable then among the left, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. It was. It seemed not only fashionable, it seemed logical. It's hard for anyone talking with someone at lunch, you know, if you're born generations later, if you're born in the 60s, it's very hard to explain to anyone what it was like to be coming of age in the 1930s, seeing the breadlines, seeing the growth of fascism, and seeing what seemed to be two sides lining up. One seemed to be fascism, as popularized by John Strachey and the coming struggle for power and all of these books that we read on one side, and what seemed, and I emphasize seemed, to be communism on the other, which was supposed to be a kind of extension almost of a sort of socio-economic Christianity is almost the way it came across, from each according to his ability to each according to his needs. We've seen recently how well that was translated, say, in Romania. It was just from each according to his, from his needs to us.
Yeah, I imagine these old
according
time,
to our needs.
Yeah, these old time leftists must be really spinning, seeing these things they believed in.
Every day that I pick up the paper, I wonder what are they? Well, some of them I can ask, but what are they thinking? What are they thinking now?
We're almost out of time. I had one or two other quick questions. I'm sure I could spend the next 2 or 3 days asking questions, but boxing. You know, I think the harder they fall. But how did you become interested in boxing?
Same way I became interested in Hollywood, in a way. The reason that, like in the short story book of Love, Action, Laughter, the reason I write about boxing, and the reason I write about Hollywood, or the reason I write about Mexico, is because those are the areas that I knew. My father took me to fights at least twice a week. I got to know fighters, boxers, very early in my life. I got to like them a lot. I was struck by their sensitivity. I've always felt, talking to baseball players, I asked myself, why is it that boxers seem so much smarter than baseball players? Well, they seem to be much more sensitive than baseball players. Naturally, that's an exaggeration, and I'm sure there are some very intelligent baseball players. But as a group, I think that you'll find that the boxers are much more individually sensitive as a group than the other groups. And I think that it's no accident that so many writers, whether it's Hemingway or Mailer or Nelson Algren, you can go down a long list of Jack London. So many writers have been attracted to fighters. And also vice versa. I think there is some tie that they have, some bond that the writer has with the fighter.
Well, Bud Schulberg, we're out of time. I wish I had some more time to ask you some more questions. I was particularly interested in some of the your relationship with some of these other authors. I love the chapter in the Writers in America, which you, as a young college student, tramp over the hill to see Sinclair Lewis. That was in the Marvel. You know, he was interested in the Marvel strike and all of that. And of course, your relationship with Scott Fitzgerald is something that you'll long remember as your book. Well, I congratulate you on the 50th anniversary edition of What Makes Sammy Ronan. I've wanted to talk to you for a long time. I thank you very much.
Thank you.